talk about exploitation of movies, both old and new. I'll introduce them to you from left to right. On your immediate left is FX Feeney, who's going to moderate from LA Weekly. Hello. Jack Hill, really no introduction. The real classics such as Switchblade Sisters, Bobby Brown, and Spider Baby, real classics in the genre. Next to Jack is Craig Brewer. Shocked us and pushed buttons in many different ways as an homage to the old exploitation movies like Black Snake Moments, Sam Jackson, and Christina Ricci. And finally, on the far left, the guy loves to shock us all. What more? How many more buttons can he push? Eli Roth. Possible 1 through 7. 1 through 2 right now. Possible 2. A big welcome to all these guys.
You know, when I was about 18, I saw for the first time the Louis Buñuel Andalusian Dog, where the woman's eyeball gets slashed. And then, like, the following weekend, I saw Bird of the Crystal Plumage by Dario Argento. And, you know, one was considered art and the other was not. And it was, ever since then, I've been a little bit troubled by the question. And I think that, thanks very much to the evangelism of Quentin Tarantino on this point, we're able to understand that every kind of movie can be a great movie and that has vitality and can live on. And for that reason, I would actually like to start with Jack Hill, because part of Tarantino's evangelism is the great DVD of Switchblade Sisters, which includes not only Switchblade Sisters, but your first film, The Host, a little 20-minute film, which I saw for the first time in preparation for this and thought was terrific, and felt that it was, you know, part very continuous with the rest of your work. You know, even certain lines of dialogue repeat throughout your work. And I was wondering, when you were making, you know, Switchblade Sisters, or making all these films, or Spider Baby, or any number of Coffee, what did you think would be the afterlife of the movie? How surprised are you by the fact that it's come this full circle?
Oh, well, I'm surprised that due to the miracle of home video, that people recognize that I use the same lines of dialogue more than once. I always thought nobody would ever notice. So in that sense, yeah, it's been surprising. But yeah, it's been surprising because I mean, films that were supposed to be, you know, we would play film one summer and then a big hit that might come back a second summer as a second feature thing. And now the ball hauntingly was I'm being called classics and legendary and all this, and I thought, you know, I'm naturally pleased.
Yeah.
But I'm a little baffled too.
What I understand you're gonna be making some films, or you're working to actually redo some of the pieces that you've done.
Oh yeah, I'm getting very busy now that I'm sort of famous in certain circles for when I had movies that were getting number one in the box office, nobody knew who I was or cared, you know, but now it seems different. So, yeah, I'm doing a really interesting project. These horror fans are familiar probably with these four films that I did with Boris Karloff for a Mexican company, Karloff's last four movies, and which were taken in Mexico, were totally destroyed. And so I got the scripts, and we're rewriting them, making them up to date, real kind of edgy, as they say, and looking for a taker for a four picture deal. I've got a lot of interest right now, so it looks exciting.
Fantastic.
I would just like to add that I was telling Mr. Hill on the way. I was telling that when I was 8 years old, I grew up in Boston, and my family took a trip to New York City, and it was like the first family trip to New York where my parents were from, and they were going to take us around and show us the Empire State Building, Statue of Liberty, and I got into the hotel room, and they had Spectrovision, which was unheard of to have any form of cable and R-rated movies on a television set. This was a very rare thing, and I faked having the flu so I could stay in the hotel room and watch The Cheerleaders over and over and over. And I probably watched it 4 or 5 times in a single day. I knew every line, and my brothers were so jealous of me. But I blew off going to New York City and looking at the city so I could watch this film. Well worth it, that's all I can say.
You were 8 years old? 8 years old. Oh, I think I was 12 when I made the picture.
Now, Craig, I'd like to ask you a question that, by all means, everybody weigh in on it, but I, you know, in seeing Black Snake Moan, or Hustle and Flow too, actually, but Black Snake Moan in particular has a very dreamlike, or to me, it was the intensities of the confrontation were almost dreamlike because they're just sort of primal and happening very immediately. And I wondered how much do you draw from your dreams? You know, it's also a bit of the Hustle and Flow too has a kind of, I don't know, it's like a waking dream about the characters in a certain way. I wondered if you were conscious of that or if you work from dreams. And that's a question I would love, you know, Jack and Ely to weigh in on. And in another way, music. Because I think part of the texture of the dreamlike thing that I may be responding to is your use of music. So I'm wondering how important dreams and music are to all of you. But you first, Craig.
It's really strange because I know I haven't stopped dreaming, but like I think I've gotten to that place where it's like I really don't remember dreams that I have anymore. But man, I can zone out like nobody's business, and I can just kind of get into a certain thought. But usually, with music, I found, I mean, in my city, it's hard not to listen to music and not know some of its historical context. It's a city where you're constantly around musicians. You know, I got musicians in my family and musicians who are friends, and a lot of the songs that they're writing are coming out of problems or fears or anxieties. And for me, at least particularly with Black Snake Moan, Hustle was a different thing. Hustle, I would listen to like Memphis rap music, and I began to, for the first time in a long time, get angry again. And it wasn't necessarily that I had to get angry at a thing, be it political or emotional, but I needed to kind of blare some music with a real solid 808 bottom bass to it and feel alive. And I think because I was working in, you know, nothing against Barnes & Noble, but, you know, shelving bargain books all goddamn day, and when I would listen to that music, it inspired an attitude, you know, and the attitude matched with a lot of the rappers that I knew, and so I really that particular music served that part of me. But with blues, I think it me analyzing blues at that time, even though I've loved it and listened to it all my life, it's like it came to my aid. I was at a very bad time during trying to get Hustle and Flow going. And that's, a lot of people don't know that I actually wrote Black Snake before I started shooting Hustle and Flow. And so it was really coming out of a time of great, great anxiety and pain. And yeah, it all kind of came to me in a vision. I know that sounds really silly, but I was listening to some blues music one night, and I just saw the radiator and I saw the chain and more so I heard the yell. I heard her going clang and hearing that clang, because that's what I felt like. I felt like I was just a crazy girl on the end of the chain. Somebody yanked me back real hard.
How about you? You were using Vivaldi. Where are you between takes on Hostel? And
yeah, we like to, you know, have an atmosphere, classical atmosphere on set. My father is a psychoanalyst and specializes in analyzing dreams and interpreting dreams. And so I grew up very, in our family, always openly discussing our dreams and, you know, stuff we talked about at breakfast, at the dinner table. I mean, wow. Any kind of dream stuff. And, it's weird because you really can't, I mean, you couldn't lie to my dad. He just knew when you were lying. So we kind of gave that up long ago and, you know, started sort of utilizing him as a resource to psychoanalyze girls who weren't paying attention to me and me when I wasn't being paid attention to, and all sorts of things. But it was, so I've always written down my dreams, and there are techniques you can train yourself to do to remember them, and a lot of that imagery certainly came into play in things in Cabin Fever and in Hostel. And as far as, and I worked with, you know, David Lynch a long time. David Lynch is always big, you know, has always that dreamlike quality to his films, which I always loved and admired. And the wonderful thing about horror films is that I feel like, you know, someone had once said, I forget who coined the phrase, they said that movies were almost the closest representation, conscious representation to the feeling of dreaming. And within that, I always feel like horror movies, for me, really can give you the closest feeling of what it's like to have a nightmare. And that horror movies, you know, Guillermo del Toro's films, they have a very dreamlike quality that there doesn't have to be logic. You can't, if you logically thought out, you know, The Grudge or The Ring, it wouldn't be scary at all. But when you're in that moment, in that terror, it really gives you that feeling of a nightmare, which is something, even though my films are very, you know, so far have been very reality-based, I still try to have that feeling of things being a nightmare where things don't always make sense. And when I write, I have, you know, very specific music that I write to. If it's the soundtrack for Twin Peaks, or the music from The Grudge, The Shining, there's certain scores that I listen to whenever I'm writing a scene, and when I'm shooting a scene, I always usually cut the scene to the song I wrote it to, and then, you know, score it.
Right. How about you, Jeff? Does it resonate with your way of working, or?
Yes and no. I mean, I've always, since I grew up as a musician myself, I was a composer and arranger and concert artist before I got into making films. I always worked very closely with my composers, and I've been very lucky to have good composers, but because that's particularly when you're talking about a whole bunch of films like this, music is really, really important. You know, kind of take their mind off things that aren't missing,
right?
In production. And but I've been very lucky to work with really fine composers, and I worked closely with them. I never scored my own film yet, but I may. But as far as being influenced by working with music as a creative thing, no, I have never done that. I found acid worked pretty well, just kidding.
I will say that certainly in my first two films, with Cabin Fever, we had our music budget for actual, you know, we had the score, and which my composer Nathan Barr did, and was doing everything, playing every instrument. And then for the other music, we had, I think, $1,000 left. So I was like, I don't know how I could fill up a movie for $1,000, but we found David Hess, who had done all the music in Last House on the Left. I went to a screening of it, actually, at the Egyptian, and it had this kind of weird early 70s folk quality to it, and I thought, nobody has this fucking music in a horror movie. And it's fantastic, and I thought, like, it's such a thing of the moment, that kind of early 70s Vietnam, Harry Nilsson quality,
right,
to these incredibly violent imagery, which was sort of what was happening at the time, that, you know, I was able to find him, and I said, look, you know, this is kind of the trade-off, and that I don't have much money, but I love this music, and it can help reintroduce to a whole new generation. And that was sort of the same deal I did on Hostel, which we did for $4 million, and still found ourselves with very little money for music. I went to these artists that had this kind of Czechoslovakian communist pop music that was huge in 1982, and I was like, I'm actually presenting it in the movie. They go to Slovakia, and like, that's a new song. That oddly was the most offensive thing to the Slovaks. They're like, how do you think we have Michal David? Why do you think Tuplatanka is number one? And they didn't have all talk about it. But, but I also saw movies like The Waterborne. I was like, oh man, they could afford Rush. Like, I always got so jealous. like, this fucker's got two AC/DC songs, man.
Low budget is fun.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money on Hustle and Flow, it was really kind of cool because all these cats from Stax are still around. From Stax Records, is in Memphis, Tennessee, and that's where we did all the music. So we had on our score for Hustle and Flow, we had Skip Pitts, who does the wah-wah guitar on Shaft, and Willie Hall, the famous drummer, who has like one of the best lines I think in cinema history. He's in the Blues Brothers. He's the drummer. And he's like, Jay Gelwood, it's great to get out of jail. How are things going? You got that money on me, motherfucker? That's Willie. And Willie's responsible for that very specific hi-hat sound that's in the song of Shaft that goes kind of like that. And that goes up like that. And rappers in Memphis, they sent that you have to have that particular type of hi-hat, otherwise it's not really like Memphis. So we got all those cats, so the music's very important.
But that's one of the great things about low budget is that it forces you to think and to like look, and you can find a lot of these people. And you know, I'm just saying, if you had more money, you might not have had 3-6 Mafia. I mean, there's all sorts of wonderful things about your film that came from that raw creative energy.
I wanted to ask you a question, Eli, that we could also open to others, which is that, you know, one thing that very much impressed me when I saw Hostel, I went a little bit in fear of Hostel because I knew kind of what it was about. And, oh man, am I going to survive the torture? But
that's what I want to do. That's great.
But I was very impressed because, definitely you hit the nail on the head graphically a few times. It's sort of like, I mean, from the Thanksgiving trailer in Grindhouse, we know you're not afraid to show anything.
By the way, I thought that would be no problem, the girl landing on the knife. I couldn't believe that people were... I'm so out of touch. What are you talking about?
I thought it was really interesting because of the anticipation you create. You do show us stuff, but you also... You're very good at like cutting away and using the sound and our imagination. Yeah. Imagination being infinitely more powerful sometimes than any image you can do.
Sure.
So I wanted you to talk about, and everybody to talk about, where you draw the line in terms of how you calculate what to show, what to hold back.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that first thing is that you're never going to please everybody. And I remember, in the first screening of Hostel, even in Hostel Part 2 where the kid gets shot, people at first meet, people are like, dude, you should fucking put the gun in the head and fucking shot the kid in the head. What more do you want? Talk to my dad, dude. Don't talk to me. The truth is that when I'm writing the film, I always think of the audience and I think of what would take me out of the story. And I feel like violence is an ingredient, and it's like you're cooking. And if you put too much of your favorite ingredient, it can spoil the whole thing. And you have to, if you have too much violence, it's cartoony. And if you have not enough violence, then people are pissed off. And it depends what expectations you create. If I go see, if I'm watching Robert Wise's The Haunting, or if I'm watching The Andromeda Strain, I don't expect gore. And if I'm watching a ghost film like The Ring or The Grudge or something, Sixth Sense, I don't need to see that violence. But if I'm seeing Saw and it's PG-13, I feel fucking ripped off. So you have to, it is weird. Like when I'm filming, I shoot everything because you got to have some takeaways to the ratings board and there's always extra stuff on stuff in DVD. And really in the editing, I kind of see and feel when I'm getting bored because honestly, I hate to say it, too many shots of a dick, of scissors cutting off a dick, it's boring. But if you have just the right amount, you can go, then you're good. And that's it depends what you want from the scene.
That's called pacing.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people aren't very good at. I can't tell you how many times I've had producers and people tell me, we want wall-to-wall action. Nothing is more boring.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you overdo it, right, and plus people, you have to know what the audience is expecting, and I know in the Hostel 2 they're expecting lots of violence. Give them a little at the beginning, and then tease them, and tease them, and tease them, and hit them hard in the middle, and then tease them again, and then just give them that barrage at the end, and we're done.
Yeah. Craig, about the sexuality, in Black Snake Moan, you had to make a lot of those kind of decisions. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of in that same thing. Like, I think my gauge or my, I'm wondering if I'm a little messed up, but I just really didn't think I knew the image was going to be interesting and engaging and titillating and offensive, the whole chaining up of the white girl to the old black man's radiator. But in the context of, Northern Mississippi Hill Country Blues, in the context of, R.L. Burnside and T-Model Ford and, Mississippi Fred McDonald, there's these blues musicians that those kind of stories are, I would put that in that Southern iconography, And so I didn't think it was going to be, shocking as some people did. But what I do find really interesting is something that I didn't realize until I got into the audience and watching Black Snake Moan with an audience. And it was this one scene where Christina Ricci's character, she's like in a fever dream fit. She can't really think, she's just covered in sweat. And Sam Jackson's character kind of turns her over and she's got a bloody mouth. She had been beaten and he found her on the side of the road. And he's like holding her going, miss, look at me, I'm gonna get you well, I'm not gonna harm you, everything's okay. And my name's Lazarus. And she's like, Lazarus, yeah, my name's Lazarus. And she goes, Lazarus, Lazarus. And then she lunges forward.
Right.
And she kisses him. I mean, it's just her mouth just cut, covers his mouth. Mm. And it's really been interesting to watch audiences flinch and go, like, I mean, I've seen it, like, they get really, like, shocked, like, oh my God, she kissed him, and it's like, we knew it was going here, you know, and now it's going on, you know, they're gonna start fucking, and then someone's gonna walk, then someone's gonna walk in and see that, and then, you know, it's gonna be bad for Sam, and there's all of that kind of stuff that's within that very interesting kiss between two people, she didn't even know who she's kissing, you know.
Right.
This is the great thing about it having pictures in a theater, and you guys have seen how audiences react. I think it was when I first started, when I first made the first big hit movie, which was The Big Dollhouse, first time I ever saw audiences getting up and talking back to the screen. They would even, some of them run up the aisles. You know? You just don't get that with home video. You know?
When I was watching Foxy Brown, I was thinking about that. I was like, I can't imagine what this would have been like in a theater in Memphis, Tennessee. I wish I could see some of those.
It was frightening. I saw Coffee when it opened in Pasadena. Urban, let's say, neighborhood. Right. It was almost frightening. People were screaming at the screen, you know. Kill him! You know, this kind of stuff. That's not what I had in mind. It's catharsis.
Yeah, no, I mean, now if I watch the movie and everyone sits there dead quiet, silently paying attention the whole time with their eyes on the screen, I've really fucked up.
Yeah.
Because people should go, no, fuck it all! And that's what you live for, those kind of comments.
I wanted to...
I used to hide under the seat, I think, in the theaters, Dracula came on, but that was earlier.
That actually is a great question. I mean, what drove you under the seat, if anything? Are there any movies that really just scared the, you know, because you're clearly really good at it now, or like that moment of the kiss is shocking because you think she might be attacking him, too. It's such a violent moment.
This little teeny girl.
I mean,
they're so afraid of her. Like a little pit bull. Yeah.
She's wonderful. I mean, Christina,
she's
awesome. The moment that drove me in the seat, when I was six, I saw The Exorcist, and that fucked me up pretty good. And I'm like a cable system in the hotel, and I wanted to watch The Killer Bees, like a good 70s movie.
Right.
And my dad's like, well, if you want to watch a scary movie, there's a movie called The Exorcist. Scary, but my mom's like, Sheldon, no. He can, and I was like, no, I'll see it. And it was the same thing, I wanted to challenge myself, and I was petrified. My brothers were all under the cover screaming, but I made it to the end of the film. Traumatized me. I didn't sleep for probably 2 years. Then I went to see Alien, and I remember that was the movie that made me want to be a director. But by the end of the film, I was so freaked out when the alien was in the room with me, and I was just rooting for the cat. That was the only thing. I just want to make sure the cat lives. And I remember, you know, the aliens and the thing with Schwarzenegger, and I was so terrified. I was going to leave, and then she starts taking her clothes off, and I was like, well, she asked me this alien like this. And then I went outside the theater, and I puked. And then I started a trend where I actually saw John Baptist Dracula, and I threw up. And I remember going to see horror movies, and my parents were like, we think there's some connection with you seeing, you know, these disgusting images and throwing up. I was like, no, I was just sick. I was a little blind. And then we finally went to see Outland with Sean Connery, and it wasn't even the violence. It was just the thought that maybe I would throw up that was making me throw up at this point. So the heads exploded on the screen. My parents just looked at me, and I went, what? And I ran around the house with my projectile vomiting over like six rows of people. I kept running. My mom chased me into the bathroom, and I was like, Mom, you can't come in here. I puked all over me. I was like 11. She's like, you are never seeing anyone. Like, you are never seeing anyone. And then they wouldn't let me see Raiders. And I was like, it's not a horror movie. They're like, yeah, but people's faces melt. I was like, I can handle it. And I went to see Raiders, and I had to prove that I couldn't puke. And I sat there, and I'm like, I didn't puke. And that was it. And then I became obsessed with, like, making people vomit. That's probably where it came from. My parents shockingly, I was in front of girls. I was sawed in half with a chainsaw. And then I was so happy that at the Alamo Draft House, there was actually a running puke in Hostel that Aaron Wall was photographed with his camera. He posted it on news. I was like, I can retire now. I got someone else to do a running puke. That's like winning the fucking Fallberg. It's like better than the Oscar.
How about you, Greg? Was there any?
In terms of those kind of crazy movies, they all oddly or obviously lead to sex in one way. And what I mean by that is, I remember going over to my neighbor's house, and they had Showtime. and late at night, they were playing Humanoids from the Deep.
Oh, yes.
The Roger Corman movie, right? And this just, you know, I was not, obviously not supposed to be seeing this. Like, they had gone to bed, and I was, you know, I was kind of hanging out at their house, and this movie was on, and it just had, you know, breasts, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. But then, and those of you who've seen the movie, I'm sorry if I'm ruining this, I'm not, spoiler fucking alert, let me tell you.
Barbara Bach.
The pregnant scene at the end of that movie, like a woman who's been impregnated by one of these humanoids from the deep, is pregnant, full term, and the green creature is clawing itself out of her pregnant tummy.
Yeah.
And I remember I was looking at the hallway waiting for them to come in, and I was just holding there in this shock. That and watching Funhouse over my girlfriend Anita's house. just watching movies we shouldn't be watching and doing things we shouldn't be doing. That's the thing about movies is that you have to think of the experience of watching them, like Gator Bait. I remember watching Gator Bait with my granddad, Marvin, and he was just this country boy he was a famous baseball player. His name was Marvelous Marvin Thronberry. He played for the Yankees and the Mets. He was part of the worst ball teams in history. But he'd go on these tours, and we'd get together. He knew I liked movies when I was a kid, and he'd rent, you know, our generation, renting movies was suddenly this renaissance of seeing all this stuff, you know. And I remember shutting the shades and saying, you know, your mother probably doesn't want you watching this movie, but you can watch this with me. And that's how I was introduced to Gator Bait with Dakota. And like, you shouldn't be seeing.
Well, I want to start opening it to questions from the audience. It's a little hard for me to see your hands in this light. I hope my assistants with the microphone. There's a question from Jeff Wells right there. We get a microphone to him up front. Is there a microphone on the way? There we go. Second row, right there. Jeff in the black shirt, right there. And anyone else have a question? Okay, gentleman over here at the far. And okay, question next. Jeff, what's your question?
I have a screenwriter for Eli. It was excellent chops in the way the hostile suit is made. I've been told, you know, same guard reacts to that. I said the first one. The excellent shots in here, very good, you know, just the timing, the pace, and the whole thing. And it just made me think, like, I was just thinking about poor Michael Bay, I feel like he's stuck in being Michael Bay. Do you think that maybe, like, in the same way that when Dustin Hoffman did The Graduate, he did Rats of Wizard, do you feel that maybe you should, to get out of being, quote-unquote, Eli Roth, should you switch over and do something like The Haunting, or something that isn't the trademark stuff? Because you're good enough not to just do the trademark stuff. I'm just saying that out of respect for you.
Thank you. That's a good question. I think that, you know, there are certain directors that I really admire and want to obviously try and pattern my careers after, and it's guys like Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and, you know, Peter Jackson, Sam Raimi, and David Lynch. Before I ever made Cabin Fever, I had done 20 animated short films. And I did drawn animation, that was King of the Hill style, and I did stop motion, some of which I put on the Cabin Fever DVD. And until that point, I was animation guy. It was like, that was what I was known for. I wasn't nationally syndicated, but kind of within the community, all the people at Nickelodeon wanted me to meet. And I was like, it's really funny you guys mentioned this, because I really want to make a fucked up splatter movie. And that was Cabin Fever. So I always felt kind of, I always really just want to do what I love, and I feel that, you know, I have many interests. I certainly am not interested, you know, Hostile Tone, I wanted to continue the theme of part one, but I'm not interested in trying to outgross myself that way. I had so much fun shooting this fake trailer in Grindhouse, which is, I didn't mean to do voiceover directing fails. I'm going to do voiceover for bad trailers. I wanted to do a whole movie of fake trailers called Trailer Trash, something like Kentucky Fried Movie, and I talked to a bunch of people, like other directors that want to do fake, just to totally have fun with it, something to switch it up. But yeah, I have definitely thought about that. And I certainly don't want to pigeonhole myself, but I think that the most important thing for me is to just keep doing movies that I want to see and movies that I love, and try not to get too caught up in where I am in the arc of my career, and just really do what comes from the heart, which is what I want to say.
And part two, is after the response to Hostel 2 was much smaller, the trade was all saying that the torture porn cycle, if you will, has kind of downswing.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, the market has been sated with that. Did you have any reactions to that? Do you have any responses to the very term torture porn?
Sure. Well, I think with the term torture porn, David Edelstein is a very smart critic, and I think he really opened an interesting discussion on audiences getting off on the violence, and I think that that was the subject matter of Hostel and Hostel Part 2, is people who are so numb, disconnected from themselves, they're replacing sexuality with violence. I think that a lot of critics seized on that term and basically used it to, instead of making it a subgenre of horror, make it a subgenre of pornography, which I thought, you know, it was interesting that there are some critics that advocated pirating the film, which I thought was rather sickening, basically saying it's okay to pirate a piece of shit like Hostel 2 because it's worthless torture porn. I think that, you know, with Cabin Fever was the beginning of the wave, and with Hostel, I was right on the crest of the wave, and with Hostel 2, we were a little bit late to the party. And the good news is, I was very conscious of my budget, and we made it for $10 million. So it's already now at 22 theatrically, so everyone's going to make money off it, which for the studios, that's what counts for them. And that's important for me to continue getting to do what I do. I think that, you know, I think that I was in a very difficult situation coming up against Pirates and Shrek and Oceans. I mean, these are the biggest movies in the world, the biggest movie stars, the biggest campaigns, and Spider-Man. And, you know, here's me with my kind of torture movie from Slovakia going, can't we come in October? But, you know, I was happy. The truth of the matter is that I felt genuinely, and I do feel this way, I feel genuinely lucky to get to make that film and to have it released in theaters. I feel like to get a movie that violent, with that much, that kind of out there and that politically bent, and that takes that much of a stance, to have that movie advertised and have commercials on television and billboards, for me really is a dream come true. And as long as we can do it and everyone can make money and it pushes film in the forward direction, that's really what matters.
You know, I'm going to get to your question next, sir, but I wanted to, you mentioned the quality being politically bent, and I was thinking, you know, I wanted to ask, you know, Jack and Craig also about this, about, you know, the nature of social commentary that you're able to freely spin in a movie that's fulfilling a genre, or, you know, clearly there's a morality tale aspect to each of your works, I think, and I was wondering if you could comment on that and the role that plays when you're planning a movie. And
I gotta think that over, so I'm gonna let you go first.
Oh, shit. I was doing the same thing.
Well, Switchblade Sisters, okay. In the middle 70s, you know, it's a women's liberation film on a certain level, you know, I mean, it's dealing with strong women much more than A-list movies were at that time.
And all these things, the way we look at films like this changes over time, too. I mean, as the society changes. And Switchblade Sisters, much to my surprise, many, many, many years later, when it kind of got resurrected, I discovered that the company that had it on home video over many years was selling it as a lesbian cult film. Go figure. And, you know, I never had any such idea, but I mean, actually, you could see that, actually, you did, because it has to do with, like, friendship between women and caring between women, which, you know, maybe that's one reason why the picture holds up and works. But at the time, I wasn't really thinking of that. I was just thinking about doing what I thought felt good, like a good story, you know?
Mm-hmm. Craig, in terms of the moral core of Black Snake Moan, for example, where, you know, there's a religious dialogue going on among the characters, and you must have had to think about how to engage the audience without them feeling they were being preached to.
Yeah. I don't think there's a way to win at that, but there's a tremendous amount of biblical imagery in Black Snake Moan, and it's because I think once again it just gets back to the music. I you know, in that, in my region, it's not, you can't escape from religion. You know, even if you're going to be against it, you will be passionately against it. And it helped me creatively. I was, you know, like I said, it was kind of a bad time, and you know, I needed to have a little bit of structure. I needed to have family around me. I needed to believe, you know, my dad had died of a heart attack. That's kind of like what got Hustle and Flow going. He came out of left field. He was 49, a very healthy guy, and I guess I was really beginning to just question my own mortality like everybody else does, but I think more so with Black St. Moan, I started thinking about Genesis a lot, and I started thinking about Genesis, because the cool thing about Genesis is that you can kind of decriminalize. It's like, it's so fantastic, like even people, you know, I'm not a literalist by any means, but it just seems like a fantastic parable to just like look at things. And so I just began thinking a great deal about, like, well, when man sinned, well, and Adam and Eve sinned, like, how did God feel kicking them out of the garden? Like, what, you know, as that's how I felt. It's like, man, I'm just ruined, you know. I'm sinner right here, you know. Fuck up right here. And I wanted to know if, I think, you know, now looking back at Blacksnake, like recently I even watched it again, and I was thinking a lot about, you know, I think I was just kind of wanting my dad to go, it's okay. You know, it's like, don't worry about it, this is all going to pass. And so I wanted to put that in the movie, and I knew that it was going to be probably criticized. I think a lot of people are surprised that there's actually kind of odd, people have called the movie conservative. Many Christian groups come up to me, strangely enough, about Black Snake Moan, saying that it's an oddly religious movie. They were surprised that there would be religion in it.
I've had similar experiences. Not with Christian groups, they call me the anti-Christian. And all three of my films have been officially condemned by the Catholic Church. That said, I think that certainly in the way that people might look at your movie and see the girl change the radiator and what is it, and then see the movie and realize that there's heart and there's thoughts, that I do think that specifically with Hostel and Hostel 2, people get so blinded by the violence that that's all they seize on. But when you're writing the film, I mean, look, Hostel 2 is about a corporation that profits off the death of Americans. And that's what the movie essentially is. I mean, both Hostel and Hostel 2 have a very moral core to them.
Yeah.
And that the way these guys treat the hookers in Amsterdam is the way they get treated. They're making fun of them and like they're pieces of meat, and they themselves get bought and sold as pieces of meat. And in Hostel, and I look at Fargo, and Fargo, there's that wonderful thing of how nothing's ever enough for anybody. Everybody wants a little bit more, down to Margie Olmsted's husband, who isn't satisfied with a 3-cent stamp. He wants a 15-cent. And it's really fucking smart. It's so well done. And you don't get it at first. And then a friend of mine pointed out, we watched it again, and it's so consistent that Margie's the only one who's happy with what she has. So that was a theme that I put in the first Hostel, where the guys, they don't want American girls. They want European girls. Everybody wants a little more. And that's what gets everyone. They even have sex with the Slovak girls, but go back for more, because it's a better story. That's what gets them into trouble. And then these guys, you know, these American guys, I mean, it's all very much a critique of my feelings that there's a very small group. At the end of the Hostel 2, it's whoever has the most money controls who lives and who dies. And that's how I feel it is with, like, Dick Cheney and these Halliburton fuckers. I feel like they're making decisions about Americans who go over there, and it's just getting worse and worse. And it's, to me, it's just amazing when the religious groups go after me, because they're the ones who put a lot of these cocksuckers in power. Genuinely get so upset about something that you know is fake, that we're all saying is pretend. You're seeing the actors and telling you it's a magic trick and showing you how I do it on the DVD. And we're all coming out and saying this is stupid, but people, they seize on the violence. And it's interesting, I just came back from Europe where I was doing the international press, and nobody asked me about the violence. The word misogyny never came up once. The women who've seen it, generally, like, people have come up and they call Hostel 2 a feminist film. I'm like, it is. It's like a very moral. But people, with my film specifically, they season the violence, and I know that, and the violence blinds them, but you just hope over time. I don't think people get a lot of the stuff the first time watching, they're just into the story, which is fine, but I think with DVD, people watch it over and over and over, and if you give them, if you put that thought into it, and you put theme into a film, people love it, they want it.
Yeah. I think you'll find really, really interesting in 20 years from now what people see in your films that you can't begin to imagine.
Yeah.
That's what I've been going to.
We're still here.
There's a guy who's actually writing a book about my films, and he's a Scottish guy. He's mm-hmm. Scottish, and he's writing a book. And he's studying all these films, and he himself is a Marxist. And he's seeing all this stuff, and he's asking me these questions, like, what? These political things. Look at this. I keep telling him, look, it just seemed like a good story, you know? Like, it was funny. I mean, I've got in Switchblade Sisters, there's a black girl revolution, she's waving
Mao's well-read book, and I'm quoting from Chairman Mao. And he didn't realize that that quote, you know, it's a joke.
Yeah.
It got the movie banned in Indonesia, by the way. And he's saying, you know, is this what you're feeling? Jeez.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, Deep Red, Dario Argento had communist feelings. I mean, there's like, it's no accident that movie's called Deep Red. And there's, you know, even movies that I, that you would totally write off as a joke. Films like Bloodsucking, which Burma asked me to do the commentary because the director wouldn't do it. This was 1996, and my buddy was an editor at Troma. It was like, if you do it, we'll call you Blood and Guts Expert. This was 96. So we did the commentary, and I was talking about it, and kind of doing like a fake dissertation. And I actually tracked down the director and talked to him, and I'm like, is it me, or is your movie actually a satire of the New York theater world? He's like, absolutely. Started it with Joseph Papp. The critic was Clive Barnes. And like, whether or not it came across, they fucking thought that shit out. If that actually, Bloodsucking Freaks had a fucking purpose to it. Which is amazing. I watched it again, and I'm like, oh my god, you have... And then I talked to the guy, I tracked down the actor Dan Foss, he plays it. He's like, yeah, I was reading Variety, I was doing Columbo, but the director and I, we talked about the cat. And like, you know, even Mother's Day, which I thought was odd, decapitation. No, the character's named Ike and Adley. It's like, this is the overflow of the American sewer system. That's, and they're like, and if you listen to the director commentary, they're like, look, we put a television in every single scene and we shot fake commercials. Like, you can see that even if they didn't pull it off, with a lot of these people, the intent was there, which is really cool.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because I've never had any such intent.
Well, you know, it's funny that it has been said about story, what separates a storyteller from an essayist, and an essayist has something to say explicitly, but what a storyteller can offer is understanding. If you offer an understanding to people, they're going to bring their own understanding and thoughts to it. It's just like a magnet. It's going to...
Right, and it changes over the generations.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We've kept a question waiting over here, and I apologize to you, sir, if you have your microphone still. Yeah.
Mr. Brewer and Mr. Rock, I just want to let you guys know, I listen to your concert. Thank you for being my film school and top film school. I really appreciate that. Question for you, Mr. Rothfeld.
Please, call me Jack.
My question is, I was reading about the remake of The Cannibal Holocaust. I was curious to know, how do you feel that American society today, or the world today, the audience today, kind of reacts to the film if it's anything like the original?
Well, it's interesting, because I actually just saw the director of Cannibal Holocaust in Italy, Ruggero Deodato. Very funny dude.
He's a cannibal in Holocaust.
And he plays the cannibal. He makes the cameo as the cannibal in Hostel Part 2. That was a little inside joke. My feeling is that if it's a good movie, people will love it. And that's what matters. It's not the subject matter or the cannibalism. It's whoever the director is and how they handle it. I mean, people ask me a lot about remakes, and I think they always say that, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing is one of my favorite films of all time, and even though it came off the source material, you could classify that as a remake. Bill Coffin's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Chuck Russell's The Blob, the Hammer films, the Dracula remakes. I think if someone makes a great movie, people will respond to it. So hopefully they'll make a great film.
We had a third question over. Yes, you, sir. Get the microphone to him, that gentleman. Thank you.
This question for Eli. I just want to tell you, Hostel 2, I think, is so great. It's the quintessential movie of the end of the Bush era.
Wow.
Such a beautiful movie.
Thank you. You're very good at picking questions, by the way.
I should ask you about one thing that's sort of much better than the next. This scene just blew my mind. The first scene in the room with Roger Bart and Warren German.
Yes.
Which, the thing that I think is so cool about it is, it's incredibly scary, but I also found it incredibly moving as well.
Thank you.
Like, the moral tension of it is powerful. And I just want to talk, just ask you about the genesis of that.
Sure.
How you hit that tone.
Well, so well. For those of you who haven't seen the film, one of the guys who's paid has kind of reluctantly gone along to kill these girls. He sort of doesn't really want to do it. When he first gets in the room, he realizes that one of them is going to die, and they can't just walk out of there, because this place is like a maximum security prison now. And he's got to go through with it, because it's gone too far. I liked creating characters. I wanted to create villains that you kind of liked, and you really felt sorry for them. And I wanted to create the sensation that, I think one of the things I hit upon in the first one that I wanted to expand, that I showed, was when I showed someone who was doing this for the first time, almost like someone going to a prostitute, they're genuinely more scared. I wanted to show a torturer that was more scared than the victim. That, to me, was more horrifying. And I felt it was too easy to have someone go in and just start hacking, and I wanted to show the turn of the character that of why he would go and do this. And then you later look back and see that he's frustrated his wife and his own life, and it's totally effectively his wife has cut his balls off, where he sort of fulfills his own destiny. But I really thought the strength of that scene laid in that on the two actors. I thought that I was so lucky to have Lauren Sherman and Roger Hart that, and that was, you know, in a scene like that, basically you just kind of stand back and let them do their thing. And I really tried to make it about his experience being terrified in that room. I wanted the audience to think, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? And then it totally kind of takes you by surprise when you realize that he's going to go through it.
You know, what's under this gentleman's question also applies to, you know, Jack and Craig. I wanted to think, you know, in terms of the balancing of the effect you're achieving, you talked about rhythm before, how important rhythm is. And how important, I mean, working with actors, you know, that has to, you're achieving that balance of rhythm and at the same time, you know, getting the effect you want, but also being organic with them. I was wondering if you could just talk about the work you do with actors and, you know, character and effect, how you come to that.
I'm sure we all have our own ways of working. My way is, which was kind of forced on me by circumstances and which I found to be very effective. See, there's two ways of looking at it. There's the Francis Coppola way, where you rehearse and you have your actors play out the whole picture for the crew and all this and that, and weeks and weeks and weeks on. And then there's guys who just bring the actors in the set, and you stand here and say your jokes here, you know, you do this and this. And they both make good pictures. You know? They both make classic, great movies, either way. It's just an individual way of working and kind of work with the way the actors like to work. Me, I like to get the actors with as little foreknowledge as possible, so they don't quite know what they're doing. Everybody's a little uneasy, you know, and they kind of a little unsure of themselves, and it brings out stuff that they couldn't have done if they planned it. That's just my way.
With Sam Jackson and Christina Ricci, what was your work with them and you know, if you could talk about that.
It was interesting because Christina operates probably a little better with kind of what you're saying. She, it's fascinating to watch her work. You give her a standby, and she kind of just makes a click. You see it in her head, and she just changes. And you say action, and you're just it's like you're just. You know, watching an amazing ride, you know, and you're just like, oh my God, I guess I'm gonna have to say cut, you know, and then she's off, and she didn't really want to. I mean, she would do rehearsal on the day and so forth, but she didn't really want to rehearse too much beforehand. Like we would, Sam and all of us, we kind of would have like rehearsals for like about 2 weeks before we started shooting, because there was also music that had to be, performed and learned and everything. But Sam, you could rehearse all day, and I found that I like, you know, the Hustle and Flow and Black St. Moan are both, they're almost like theater, you know, they're all on one set, and so I kind of like to take down the floor and get ideas from them, you know. I mean, I learned a lot about directing actors through Terrence Howard and Sam Jackson and Christina Ricci.
Yeah, it's amazing really how much changed. You learn from your actors and your
production. Yeah, yeah, and I look at half of my movie sometimes and go, thank God I had them coming up with those ideas, and or thank God I went with their idea than my idea.
You know, it's interesting about the movies we're talking about. Oftentimes they, for budget reasons, they have to have be restricted to just one or a very few sets. And I'm wondering if you could just all address that issue, because it's interesting having to focus on a couple sets forces you maybe to be more creative, I would think. But if you could comment on the effect that has on your imagination.
I think that limitations stimulate your creativity, you know, and that's part of the fun of low-budget movies. In fact, I kind of grew up on the Warner Brothers movies of the 40s, and those guys had to work in very tight budgets, and they didn't have great effects and things like that, and they came up with these great ideas that, you know, they had actors like Bogart and Cagney, you know, the MGM with all the money, what do they have?
Right.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, everybody watched the Warner Brothers.
Taylor.
Yeah.
I'm for anything that's just going to bring some tension. No, I mean, for tension, I think, is like the hardest thing in films to create. You know, if you go too much, then it's stupid, you know, and so having just Sam, there was whole days where it was just Sam and Christina. I mean, that's the whole movie, really. But more so with Hustle and Flow was harder, because it was like seven or six of us sometimes in one room, and we were really shooting in a small little set. We made Hustle for about $2.5 million and shot it on like 23. 3 days, I think, and so we were just running and gunning, trying to get that movie made. But we had felt, I mean, that energy just bleeds into the material you're creating. You know, we really felt like those guys in that room making music.
Yeah, I had that on Cabin Fever, which is $1.5 million, 24 issue. You just have to learn to live without the words exterior night. And if you notice, there's almost no night in Cabin Fever or Hostel because I couldn't afford it at all. Cabin Fever was all in a room and said, okay, if we're shooting this all in this cabin, it's got to be, we have to take some creative liberty and kind of have an Evil Dead 2 cabin where there's depth and there's, like, every time we look at it, we can't just have a flat wall. Every single shot and every angle that we shoot from has to have another room, a hallway, and a window. There's got to be depth in every single shot, and there's got to be something foreground, background, and texture in the walls. I mean, we really designed the cabin.
You had great production design in cabin.
Yeah, there's a guy, Franco Carbone, who's terrific. He did a great job. I mean, but then the other stuff was practical locations, and the general store was practical. Then in Hostel, I said, okay, we got this village, and we got to shoot for 4 days in this village, even though there's almost no people, because we've been there for extras. And the rest of it's in that fucking, in those torture rooms. So that was one set that we just redressed. But again, we I showed them, you know, different photographers, Joel Peter Witkin, and different, and like saying, I want this texture. And we really, really, in the same production center in Cabin Fever, we really, really textured and layered the walls so that it would be, we're in that room for a while, but it would be an interesting room. With Hostel, you know, part two, finally, we got some more money, we put all of it into sets, and I'm like, okay, I'm shooting a whole fair sequence at night, I'm shooting outside a river by night, because I wanted to have extras at night, because I can afford, I think, one night or two nights on Cabin Fever, which is the deer, you know, like, saw me, and like, the water in the shed, and then I think we had one exterior night on Hostel, but that's just how you do it, you just write stuff indoors.
Well, listen, I want to, you know, I see we're drawing up against the end of our hour, and I just, before we go, I wanted to point out that we have Rob Bottin in the audience, an honored guest. He was, you know, he did the masks and the creatures for Legend and RoboCop, Puerto Rico, and Maine. Been a great panel. I wish we could go on talking, but you've been all wonderful, and you've been a wonderful audience. And thank you. There is time. We have time for. Oh, fantastic! All the better. Time for two more questions. Yours, Miles Wilson, here with the.
Yeah, we got 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. No, just my watch must be fast.
For Mr. Roth, knowing your material and what you guys are going for and knowing that it's all fake, because, you know, we both grew up watching Cinema Secret so that we know it's okay, but I've always wondered, watching, you know, Hostel and looking back on it, you all had a ball, obviously, but was there ever certain points where the actors felt like they couldn't take anymore, or were they just ready to, you know?
No, actors love to be tortured. They love it. They live for it. In fact, every actor that reads the script, you don't torture them physically. You have to create a very safe environment on set so they physically feel safe, and emotionally they feel like you're really watching the performance and they trust you when to pull back, when to let out. But all these actors really have something to prove. I mean, it's no accident that every single one of them were fighting to do Hostel because of those torture scenes. And they want to show that range. They want to have the light, fun, happy side, and they want to let that inner thing out that they have inside them to show that they can go to that dark place. So it's fun on set, but when we're shooting those scenes, I always give them space. I'll generally let them take their own action. I'll, like, you know, kind of leave them alone to do their thing and just let them go to wherever they need to go to and give them as much time. I really save as much shooting time as I can for those scenes, and a lot of it is just kind of letting the actor get comfortable.
Another question over the, yes, the gentleman in the blue shirt there. And hopefully if we have time, sir, we'll have your question as well.
My question is from Richard Brewer. When you were at UCLA with Black Snake Moan, you talked a lot about how it was a personal film based on things with you and your wife. One thing I was really fascinated with is how you fit something so personal into a really well-known genre, or I mean, a genre we've seen before. However, the story was unbelievably original. And I was just wondering, as we come into this new phase of people reproducing these old genre films, do you feel Can you talk a little bit about working a director's personal, not personal problems, but exercising whatever's going on with them and making the personal film, the auteur, as you want to say, and talk about integrating it into a well-known genre and whether you think that that will continue.
It's funny because when I was making Black Snake, I wasn't really trying to make the exploitation genre. And I know there's been a lot of talk about how we marketed the movie, and it's very much inspired by that. But it's also inspired by works that go beyond film. Like I was really into the plays of Tennessee Williams, but you can really look at the plays of Tennessee Williams, and it's probably about a stone's throw away from Mudhoney by Russ Meyer. Like there's a certain intensity into those characters that were very inspiring. So it's not like I really am trying to do the race baiting exploitation movie necessarily. I really wanted to do a blues movie, and so if I was going to explore that, then I was going to explore what I felt blues was, which I believe is an exorcism music, and. When I've been, in Memphis, you go over to Ernestine and Hazel's, and it's this bar that used to be a whorehouse back in the day, and you get the right band, and you get the right beer in you, and you get the right crowd around you, and you're just sweating, worry and pain and everything, and you're just, it's a really great way to roll, and so I think that on these next movies that I'm doing. I am exploring things that are personal to me. I'm doing, my next movie is a country music movie called Maggie Lynn, it's still kind of about just me and being married and trying to have kids and trying to be a dad and trying to work and all that kind of stuff. But I'm more worried that we can't make films that are personal anymore. I'll go ahead and share the story. I didn't think I was going to share this story, but. I was having this sounds very Hollywood, but I was having this meeting at the chateau. We all want to meet at the chateau, fine. And I'm sitting there, and it was after Black Snake Moan had come out, and Black Snake Moan had not performed as well as Hustle and Flow, and so I was feeling a little down, and I remember looking at the magazine rack in the chateau, and there was a Grindhouse was about to come out. It was like five magazines of Grindhouse, and there were two magazines that had Christina Ricci on the cover. And I remember thinking, well, one day, I'll earn kind of like an audience, like, because I'm, what Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino have carved out, it's so amazing, they truly are pioneers. And I'm like, well, that's one thing to earn, is one day to have this kind of attention, because Grindhouse is going to come out, it's going to be just huge. And then it came out, and I heard that it wasn't doing well either, and I went to see it on Sunday, and I was so blown away by Grindhouse. I just thought it was great, and it made me miss home and everything, and I got suddenly really depressed. I really got depressed. Like, what?
You and I can probably train.
But it made me think, like, wow, like, that's... Are we now coming into a phase where the $40 to $50 movie ticket investment is really only for like a ball game? And that the rest of it's going to have to be when people eventually see it. People stop me all the time about Hustle and Flow, and they talk about how amazing it was. They didn't think it was, what they thought it was going to be. And I asked them, well, when did you see it? And they said, well, I saw it on Showtime or I rented it on DVD. And now, that for me... That's a big, exciting time. Black Snake Moan came out this last week. I'm getting a big old kick out of everybody seeing it. And so I'm worried that the economy now is not going to allow personal movies to be done in the over $15 million budget.
I watched Wild Hogs on the plane right back. And I almost fucking jumped. It's just like this wave of just genuine sadness came over me. No offense to filmmakers, no offense to those guys. That movie made almost $200 million. Every other joke is you fag this, you fag. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? This is what's okay. that fucking kids and everyone's going crazy for it. That is the most, if people go after me because I had a fucking frat boy say fag in a movie, I was like, is this, I was like, the fucking world's ending. Like, is this what we have to do in order to keep making our films? It's fucking, that's the sad state of it.
Amen.
And on that note.
The gentleman right there in the third row, yes, there he is.
Hi, thanks. I just have a question for Eli. I just want to know, like, you had to fight, I know you had to fight with the MPAA a lot for the first Hostel.
I've never fought with the MPAA, genuinely. I'll tell you where I fought, Germany. They just took my movie, completely recut it, and said that's it.
But, and then it's not like Hostel Part 2, and then you had like a full-on castration in the movie. And I was like, how could they like fuck? Because like, what you had in Hostel Part 2 was like, in Hostel Part 1 was tame in comparison.
Yeah.
Like, how did you get that, like, the okay that, but like, they had to fight them for the first movie?
Well, I had a good discussion with the MPAA, and I will tell you this, the MPAA in this, you know, everyone says, oh, the MPAA, you guys must have fought. Honestly, from where I'm sitting, fucking thank God we have the MPAA, because they are the only board out of every country that I deal with where I get a voice. Japan did not release Hostel, because we had an American disfiguring a Japanese girl's face with blood punch. Period. Sorry, not going to theaters. And then there's countries like Singapore, it's not going to theaters. Okay, fine, we get that. Japan, nope, sorry. So now with Germany, putting the gun to the kid's head. It's fine in Pirates 3, shoot a kid, no problem. Off camera killing against it, the kids playing soccer with a head as a joke, so people leave the theater laughing. Nope. They completely cut it. They just took the violence out, even with an 18 rating, which is the equivalent of our NC-17. Here, the ratings board, I was like, look, they said, well, you know, Eli, I mean, let's be honest, we've never seen this before in a movie. And I was like, guys, let's be honest, I'm running out of body parts. If my fans don't have this in the movie, they're going to castrate me. We have to have the showstopper for all possible, and I promise I'll make a good movie. And they got it, and I was like, look, I want you guys to know that I was conscious how I shot it. You don't see the head of the cock when it happens. It's not full frontal, it's three-quarter frontal. It's not full frontal. And I knew the guy at the beginning. I was like, you didn't say anything about that. If I had a naked guy standing there, you'd have a problem with it. But wait a minute, I put a sketch pad in the girl's hands because they're in art class. So what's art and what's pornography? Because the kids are sitting there with a sketch pad in their hands, now that nude guy's okay. But because they have a scissor in their hands, that nude guy's not. And we just had a discussion about it. And they said, okay. I was like, look, what? I was like, this is going to make people feel good. I was like, every girl's going to fucking cheer. I was like, this is revenge violence. And it's not, the penis is not being used in a sexual way. And the rapist is getting punished. If you show it, it becomes a cartoony laugh. If you don't show it, then it's like people are thinking about it and building it up in their head. I was like, they actually, to show the violence makes it, in a way, more of a yeah moment and less of a horrific moment. And they understood that. God bless them. I got more cock than all every Harvey Keitel movie combined.
Greg and Jack, I mean, how about your navigations with the ratings?
Well, it just reminded me, things have really changed. You guys can't imagine how much things have changed. I mean, when I made Coffee, it's been considered an extremely violent movie, which I don't really think, because most of what happens, it happens either you just get two frames or something. But it is a violent movie. You have to blow somebody's head off with a shotgun. You know what we had trouble with? We had a scene in the hospital where it was supposed to be just kind of for background, a patient on a gurney in an emergency room, and I asked the doctor, you know, to help me tell the actor what to do. Guy in convulsions. We had to cut that before getting an X rating. That's the stupidity, the absolute stupidity of these rating people. You never know which one you're going to have to deal with or what kind of screwballs you're going to have to deal with. So you can imagine when you have worldwide all these different countries, you know, what you're running into. But it's changed so much. I mean, today you can do so much more than you could do back then. You know? I mean, X rating, an actor who voted to cut the scene.
Did you have to navigate anything, Craig, with the Black Snake Moan? I mean, that's.
Apparently, changing up an Infomaniac didn't bother me. Rated R, right off the bat. They said, you're going for rated R, right? Yep. Rated R.
All business. Yeah.
Well, when you do have an R rating, people expect certain things.
my Switchblade sisters, I wanted to have a PG rating. It was pretty, you know. Yeah, it was an R rating because anything dealing with drugs automatically is an R rating. We didn't know that at the time. So.
Well, it's weird. I'm not for it. The PG-13 is really, I think, fucked up a lot. Because, I mean, when I was a kid, like, the PG really meant parental guidance. My dad came home and said, well, the face is melted off, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I think a kid can handle it. You know? And now, like, PG-13 is this weird gray zone where, like, you milk down a rated R movie or you clip it just right where it kind of, like, loses some of its, you know, bluntness to it. And then the PG-13 movie sometimes may be, you know, too inappropriate for kids anyway, so I wish it was, you know, still the way it was, where rated R movies really had some punch to it. And then there's PG. You know.
Right. Yeah. Well, what a great, this has been a great panel. You guys are great, and you're a great audience. Thank you so much.